Mike, what is DNA Day?
It's the first time in Alberta or anywhere in Canada, as far as we're aware, where a day has been set aside to mark the achievements in the field of genetics and genomics. And we chose April because it was April 1953 that James Watson and Francis Crick first unveiled the double helix structure of DNA, and it was in April of 2003 that the Human Genome Project was completed and the human genome was published and made available.
Now, isn't this something that got its start in the United States?
Yes, it's been going in the U.S. for several years now. About 2005 is when they first did it as a national day in the United States. And it's become a fairly major event for school kids and for the general public with poster competitions and various things going on around the entire country down there.
When you look at the whole genomic sector, how big is it in Alberta?
It's certainly growing in Alberta, there's no question. We here at Genome Alberta, we are looking at the mountain pine beetle, we're looking at flax, we're looking at oil sands mitigation using genetics, and we have right now about $85 million worth of projects in our portfolio. So for us, it's significant, and for the province as a whole, it's a major part of the provincial research and innovation strategy. Genetics is one of the pillars.
Well, certainly if you watch television crime shows, it makes you wonder how we ever did things like solve crimes before DNA came along.
There's no question that it's become a very sophisticated technology. But at the same time, not only has it become more sophisticated, but as the cost of processing and equipment drops, it's become readily accessible to the point now, of course, where you can get a home genetic testing kit for a few $100 and have your own genome at least partially sequenced and come out with some very interesting information on your own human genome. So, yes, very sophisticated, but also become very cost-effective on the technology side.
Why is it then that you feel it's necessary for us to actually celebrate DNA Day?
I think, number one, there's some misunderstanding about DNA and genetics. Some people just assume that genetics is like fate and that's it. There's no turning back. I think there also needs to be more awareness about the potential of genetics in agriculture, in crops, in personalized medicine, in disease treatment. And that doesn't mean Frankenstein locked away in a lab somewhere. It's very straightforward technology sometimes. That just means what we're doing is improving the breeding of our livestock or the health of our crops without having to get involved in anything ultra futuristic or anything like that. So we saw it as a way to celebrate what is real and what can be done and what is very reachable today.
So what do you have planned for this first ever Alberta DNA Day? Who's involved with you?
Well, one of the main features that we're going to look at is a online chat room being done with Let's Talk Science, which is a national organization. And what we'll have is several geneticists available on April 15th who will be there to answer questions online for the general public and for schools. So that's one important feature. We're also going to have quite a few special videos and audio files and images available on our genomics site on Facebook. And our own website, of course, will provide a lot of links to specialized material for that day.
And the website, what's on that?
Well, the Facebook site is facebook.genomealberta.ca, and then our own website at genomealberta.ca will have the links to the other sites, and the chat room will be available at Curio City with Let's Talk Science.
Well, thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you, Cheryl.
What does DNA mean to you?
What does DNA mean to me? Well, DNA has been around for a long, long time. I think, for me anyway, as a tool for doing wildlife biology, our ability to look at DNA hasn't been around for such a long time. And I guess when I started my research in the early 1990s, we were just really starting to be able to actually look at DNA using tools in a lab, in wildlife in particular.
How do you actually go about your work?
Well, it depends on what we're doing, but normally, with the kind of work that we do, let's say, for example, we're looking at genetic relatedness of some kind of wild animal like deer or sheep or mountain sheep that my students work on. You have to start off with a piece of the animal, a very tiny piece, even a pluck of fur or a bit of skin or something, and then you extract the DNA out of that, and we only need a little bit of that to start with, and then we can use the tools of genomics to generate, if you like, DNA fingerprints for every individual, and we can do many things with that.
Well, tell me a little bit about your work with the sheep.
Well, I've been studying sheep, well, bighorn sheep, for more than a decade now. There's a couple of herds in Alberta that have been studied for about 40 years, where every animal is marked from birth and we follow them throughout their lifetime. So I've been part of a team that works on one of these populations, and we've done many different things. There's a lot of basic biology that we do, but what my group brings to it is the ability to look at the DNA of these animals. And we started off by learning about which rams sired which lambs. So do the biggest horned rams have the most offspring? It's a really basic biological question, and that was something that we were able to use DNA to do. And we've gone past that now. So now we're actually more interested in things like, well, is horn size inherited? Are other qualities or other aspects of performance inherited? Are there good sheep that have big lambs? Is that heritable? Are there genes that influence those kind of aspects, which are really tightly linked to population viability, the ability of that population to survive in changing environmental conditions and these kind of things. So what we've been able to do is use genomic tools to generate, a genome map for bighorn sheep. And we're actually trying to do things like figure out what are the genes that actually influence things like your ability to give birth to a good lamb or how big your horns are, those kind of traits. So we're actually starting to take some of the things that people have been doing with livestock and in human genetics and apply this to wildlife for other reasons.
Why is it even important to study bighorn sheep in this way? What does it really do for me?
What does it do for you? I guess you can answer that on a couple of different levels. So there's basic knowledge about wildlife species, which is the provincial animal of Alberta. People are interested in, how critters work and how they get by, how they make their living. So there's that, which is a basic science issue. I think there's also an applied issue that bighorn sheep, for example, are a species that is of great value to hunters for trophies. So people pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to shoot a bighorn sheep and keep a trophy. One of the things we've been looking at for the last 10 years or so is what is the impact of that hunting pressure on the evolution of these animals? Like, does it have an impact? If you imagine, if you wanted to make sheep that didn't have horns, the best thing you could possibly do would be to shoot all the rams with the big horns before they reproduce. And if you kept doing that, presumably they'd evolve to have no horns. That would be the logical outcome of that, according to Darwinian selection. So that's something that we're looking at. What are the genes that play a role in horn development? Does human harvesting have an impact on genetic variation at that level? Are we actually selecting against the very things that we value in these animals in the way that we utilize, utilize that resource? So that's a fundamental question that I'm interested in, which I think is, as a biologist, is fascinating because it deals with natural selection, evolution, and genetics. But I think as a resource manager or as a member of the public, this is something we should care about. We should care about whether or not our activities have a deleterious evolutionary impact, not just an impact on how many animals, but on the genetic makeup of those populations. And I think this is of value to everybody.
Well, if you were to put yourself in the shoes of Darwin, what would be the difference between what he had to work with in his day and what you're able to do today?
That's a really interesting question. So Darwin obviously knew about evolution and natural selection, but Darwin didn't know about genes. So genes were not discovered, if you like, until Mendel's work, which was after Darwin died. So I think Darwin would feel great to see that we understand the mechanisms behind evolutionary change. We understand at at a molecular level what happens, inheritance and genetic variation. And what we're learning now is we're trying to unravel these things and figure out what are the genes and how do they interact and how many genes are there and those kind of detailed questions. But I think he'd be quite pleased to see that there's been a unification of that molecular biology and evolutionary biology in the way that he phrased it. And I think largely he's been vindicated in all of his views. It's supported by the things that we do now.
How have the tools changed for you even over the last 10 years?
They're changing very quickly. So when I have a new graduate student, I always start off by telling them, back in my day, what we used to do, we had to wear three layers of gloves because you're dealing with radioactivity all the time when we were doing some of the basic DNA fingerprinting kind of stuff. I remember contaminating my shoes with radioactivity and I had to put them in a closet for 6 months until they cooled off and I could wear them again. These things don't happen anymore. We have much better equipment. We have much more capability of doing things. So my entire PhD work, the number of samples and the number of genotypes that I produced over 5 years is like a day of work now for people in my lab. It's changed so quickly. The resources that have been brought along through the human genome sequencing and all of these really basic molecular biology with model systems and livestock has really advanced the field technologically and knowledge base, and those of us who work on wildlife are, you know, are able to benefit from those breakthroughs. They gradually move over to us, and we sort of adapt them to our species. And as somebody who works on things like deer and mountain sheep, it's nice that they're not that distantly related to other mammals that there are many, many genomic resources for. Like, you know, the human genome sequence is a powerful tool for helping us to look at the genome sequences of other mammals, wildlife, and being able to apply those kinds of things. So it's very difficult to keep up with the pace of change, to be honest.
Thank you very much, David.
Oh, no problem. You're welcome.
Shiraz, what does DNA mean to you?
I don't know. It's an interesting question. DNA, I think for me, is just basically a fingerprint. Everyone has their own distinct fingerprints, and DNA just identifies you. And understanding for myself, because I'm a cancer researcher, understanding DNA and how DNA is normal is so important to understanding how cancer cells grow out of control, because what normally happens is DNA actually becomes abnormal, at least some parts of it becomes abnormal in the cancer cell. So it's important that we know DNA and we can detect it and we can analyze it.
How important is DNA to the work, the scientific work that goes on today?
It's actually pretty important. DNA was discovered, I'm not even sure, but more than 50 years ago. And it's quite simple, just four building blocks that makes up our genetic makeup. And understanding the normality, I guess, of this genetic makeup is so important to understanding the disease that you have, because almost all diseases can be traced back to genetic abnormalities or changes in the DNA that would result in you having some symptoms or disease. So it's very important to understand DNA, understand if it's normal or not, and be able to detect it.
Well, when you first start learning about DNA and genes and genomes and all of that sort of thing, can you tell me a little bit of the history? What are you taught when you go to university?
Oh, wow. That was a long time ago. What were we taught about DNA? I think the basic things that we were taught is that DNA is actually quite simple. Simple and complex at the same time. It's simple because there's only four building blocks, as I mentioned earlier, and that makes our genetic makeup, and it's the combination of these building blocks and how they are joined together that determines the outcome of a particular DNA sequence. So I think we were taught that it's simple but very complex, and it's one of those things that one of those, I guess, molecules you can actually see under a microscope under the right conditions with the right staining patterns. So I think we're just taught it's very complex, and it's important to really understand it and understand how it's put together, because that will determine disease characteristics, and actually behavioral characteristics too have been traced back to certain DNA sequences. So it's important for us to understand.
Well, if you look back at this discussion that led to the discoveries of the double helix, Watson and Crick, what do you know about those times and the discussions that went on?
Well, there's definitely a lot of stories. I think with every great scientific discovery or scientific change, there's always a lot of stories. And you might know this. I'm sure a lot of people do know the fact that the DNA was actually discovered by two people, but there was the third person involved, a female researcher. She was involved in the initial identification, and there's a lot of stories that you will probably hear that the Nobel Prize was awarded to Watson and Crick, but the Nobel Prize should have been shared by a third person. And so you hear a lot of stories, and the article was published more than 50 years ago. It's actually quite a simple article. I think it was only 3 pages long, about the identification and naming of deoxyribonucleic acid, which is what DNA stands for. And one thing you'll know if you go to England and to Cambridge, there's actually a bar called the Eagle where Watson and Crick frequently discuss DNA. And so there's a plaque to identify that this is where DNA was discussed, and certainly a lot of people do go and just to see the plaque and be in the bar where this is all discovered.
Tell me a bit about the research that you do.
Our research is very centered on cancer and understanding the origins of cancer and also in how cancer progresses. And when I say about the origins of cancer, what I'm talking about is actually DNA and how DNA is changed in individuals that are predisposed to getting cancer. We know there's a lot of sequences that are present in your DNA, or arrangements that are very susceptible to undergoing changes. And these changes happen quite early in the path to getting cancer. And so what we're investigating is, can we utilize this information to come up with early diagnostic tests for certain cancers that are very hard to detect, such as pancreatic cancer, lung cancer, ovarian cancer. These are very hard to detect cancers. So our work is very centered on diagnostics and understanding the origins of cancer. Now, connected to this is inflammation. And we also study inflammation from the perspective that if you have persistent inflammation, you are definitely more susceptible to getting cancer later in life. And our goal is to really understand this process of the link between inflammation and cancer in order to prevent these patients that may have inflammatory problems to prevent them from getting cancer later in life. So it's a monumental task that we have, but we're starting to identify specific elements that connect these two diseases. And the hope, again, we would like to reduce the incidences of cancer by preventing patients with inflammation to get cancer later in life.
The thing that really astounds me when researchers start talking about genes and the work that they're doing is they talk about aspects of genes where things are turned on or turned off and how that can really change the outcome. What does this mean, having something turned on or turned off?
It's a very interesting question and a very good comment, actually. Mother Nature has designed very interesting mechanisms to turn things on and turn things off, as you just mentioned. When we describe things as being turned on, that means the gene codes for a protein, and the protein actually has an activity that will do one thing or the other. And turning the gene on means the protein will become produced in the body and actually utilized in what's called a functional assay. If it's turned off, that means the protein is no longer being made for whatever reason, and the function of that protein is lost, which in most cases is okay, but in some cases it can actually be very detrimental. And cancer is one typical example where cancer cells have actually turned off a lot of genes that are involved in the natural program to kill the cell. And so cancer cells are very smart because they want to survive. So they've shut down the program that would cause itself to die. So they survive much, much longer than most cells. So turning genes on and off is very important to understanding biological processes and for understanding what's called disease pathogenesis or the origins of disease. Because if we can understand when genes are turned on and off, meaning they're active or not active, then we can really at least trace the origins of diseases and maybe help patients that have these diseases.
If you took away DNA, or if you were living in the days before we knew about DNA, what would that mean to the type of research in terms of trying to figure out what cancer was or what we could do about it?
If we didn't know anything about DNA, or we took away DNA or methods to look at DNA, I think we would be pretty lost, because everything is very dependent on us understanding DNA and actually being able to detect DNA. And I'm sure you probably know this. There's an initiative that was started probably about more than 10 years ago called the Human Genome Project. And the Human Genome Project's ultimate goal was to completely sequence all our DNA so we know exactly what kind of DNA we have and in what order it's arranged. There's a number of researchers in the cancer field that are sequencing patients with cancer, their entire genetic makeup, so we can really understand it, how they differ from a person who doesn't have cancer, in order to identify genes that are important for promoting a cancer phenotype or a cancer cancer appearance. So understanding DNA is so imperative, and if we don't have the tools to look at it, and if we didn't know anything about it, I think we would have been quite lost in terms of understanding diseases, origins of diseases, and how to treat diseases.
What do you see coming down the pipe? I mean, everything has changed so rapidly.
Yeah, you are correct. Our knowledge has increased exponentially over the past 10 years. But what has increased even more is our technology. And I always tell my student that technology is accelerating at a pace that we don't have enough ideas to use that technology. And I think as a cancer researcher that we have to try to utilize this technology, because technology is going backwards in terms of scale. We have now nanoparticles and things that on a nanoscale, and cells, they behave and they act on a nanoscale level. So if we can really utilize this technology to really understand biological processes, I think we can advance scientific research, for sure, not only in cancer research, but in other other fields. So the technology is quite important, and I think as we move forward, as scientists, we have to utilize all these platforms and technologies to our advantage, and talk more to engineers and talk more to people that are designing these technologies to bring them into the field of medicine and research to really understand what's happening in cancer and other disease groups. So technology is quite important to our success now and over the next 10 years for sure.
Thank you very much, Shiraz.
You're welcome.